The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles principally from the Harvard Health Letter, and this is the November 2023 issue of the Harvard Health Letter. And the first article I'm going to read is entitled Winter Activity Workarounds for Hands That Hurt. Try these strategies to accomplish winter tasks despite hand arthritis. The pain and stiffness of hand arthritis make it hard to do anything that requires nimble fingers or a strong grip. And for some people, cold, damp winter weather seems to worsen arthritis symptoms. We don't know exactly why that happens. All we have are theories, like bones expanding from changes in barometric pressure, changes in circulation, thickened joint fluid, and the effects of less exercise due to cold weather, says Dr. Robert Schmerling, a rheumatologist and senior faculty editor at Harvard Health Publishing. So how can you get through a busy winter filled with activities that demand a lot from your hands, like preparing holiday feasts or shoveling snow? The key is to plan, pace yourself, use the right tools, and enlist help if you need it. Here's how to apply that to some common winter activities. Holiday cooking. Cooking is intense work for your hands, whether you're whisking a savory sauce, kneading or rolling out dough, chopping vegetables, or lifting heavy pots and pans. Think about the steps of each recipe and ways to reduce the amount of grasping or lifting that might be required. For example, if you need to fill a large stock pot with water, place the pot on the stove first, then add water using a pitcher, so you won't have to lift a heavy pot, says Kim Stuckert, an occupational therapist at Spalding Rehabilitation Network. Pace yourself. Spread out cooking activities as much as possible so you don't overwork your hands. That could mean making one special dish per day and freezing it prior to a holiday meal, or baking holiday cookies well in advance and freezing them. And take breaks while you're cooking to let your hands rest. Use tools. Adaptive kitchen tools are plentiful, like tools with large handles that are easier to grip and put less stress on your hands, or bowls with suction cups on them so you don't have to grip them to hold them steady, Stuckert says. And when possible, use kitchen appliances, like food processors or an electric can opener, to do prep work for you. Enlist help. Consider asking family members to help with the cooking, or have part or all the meal catered if it's in the budget. It doesn't have to come from a fancy restaurant. For example, many grocery stores prepare and sell cooked turkeys and holiday dinners. Shoveling snow. Shoveling heavy wet snow is taxing on your heart and painful for arthritic hands. It hurts to grab a shovel, and it can lead to muscle strain and increased joint inflammation if you hold your hands in one position for long periods. Before you head outside, get your body ready for hard work with a warm-up, like march in place or move your arms for a few minutes. This gets blood flowing to all your muscles and tissues, including your hands, which will help keep them warm and flexible, Stuckert says. Before going out, suit up properly in cold weather gear, including a pair of compression gloves beneath mittens. The gloves will promote warmth and blood flow. Go slowly and steadily. Take breaks. Stay hydrated. Even though it's cold outside, you'll lose fluids during exercise. If it's in the budget, get a snowblower or an electric snow shovel, which you push like a lawnmower. They're pricey, but help ease the work of shoveling. If possible, hire a company to remove the snow for you. It's expensive and may require a long-term contract, If that's not in the budget, talk to family members or a neighbor about helping with snow removal. Make the arrangements now before you wake up to a blanket of new fallen snow. One of the joys of the winter holidays is giving gifts to friends and family, but gift wrapping requires hand strength to use scissors and agility in fingers and thumbs to fold paper, tape it, and tie ribbons. The repetitive movements can quickly become painful. Buy presents as far in advance as possible, so you'll have plenty of time to get them ready. Don't overdo it. Wrap just one or two presents per day. Use tools. Stuckert recommends using a large, accessible tape dispenser and adaptive scissors that you operate by squeezing a large loop rather than opening and closing two handles. Or simply use gift bags. When you're shopping, take advantage of gift wrapping services or ask a friend to help you wrap presents using walking or ski poles. Nordic walking and cross-country skiing are popular cold weather activities, and both involve the use of poles you grasp to pull or propel yourself forward. When you have hand arthritis, however, holding on to the poles for extended periods can be challenging and painful. Make sure you're holding the poles correctly. They have a glove-like strap attached to the grip. The straps need to be snug. If they're loose, your hand will work harder. If you're not sure about your technique, watch a free video on YouTube. Warm up before walking or skiing to get blood flowing to your muscles and your hands. Take rest breaks and drink some water or hot tea. Look for poles with large, thick grips, which are easier to hold than small ones, and wear a pair of heated, rechargeable mittens. Keeping your fingers together will keep them warmer than they'd be in gloves. The warmth helps joints to stay loose. An occupational therapist can help you adapt existing poles so they're easier to hold with arthritic hands. We have materials we can add to make the grip larger, Stuckert says. We can also evaluate your hand strength and prescribe a series of hand exercises to improve strength and flexibility. And now here's one of my favorite sections of the Harvard Health Letter called Ask the Doctor with Dr. Anthony L. Komaroff. And the first question is, Alzheimer's disease runs in my family. Could scientists fix the genes that cause the disease? Your question highlights something important. Even just 30 years ago, we didn't know for sure if any genes increased the risk for Alzheimer's disease, and we surely had no tools for fixing such defective genes. Today, we do know several important genes, and we have gene editing tools like CRISPR, C-R-I-S-P-R. But we're not yet ready to prevent the disease in someone like you. Here is why. A few cases of Alzheimer's occur in younger adults and are predominantly caused by defects in a handful of genes. It's possible that someday CRISPR could work for this type of Alzheimer's, but it won't be easy. While CRISPR can easily edit genes in cells in a laboratory dish, using CRISPR to edit the genes of cells deep inside the body of a living person is much harder. Attempts to edit genes inside the cells of living animals are just in their infancy. Most cases of Alzheimer's occur in older adults and do not appear to be caused by just a few defective genes. Indeed, lifestyle, particularly exercise, diet, the amount of high-quality sleep, affects the risk of developing Alzheimer's at least as much as genes. Also, there's growing evidence that smoldering, chronic, low-grade infections of the brain, acquired early in life, infections that produce no symptoms, may provoke the development of some cases of Alzheimer's. Some infectious agents, particularly viruses, can quietly infect the brain and can't be eradicated. They remain for the rest of a person's life. How might this increase the risk of Alzheimer's? One characteristic of Alzheimer's is accumulation in the brain of a molecule called amyloid beta in the form of plaques. Everyone's brain has the ability to make amyloid beta. Unfortunately, amyloid beta is a good news, bad news molecule. It helps to fight infections of the brain. That's the good news. The bad news is that amyloid beta cannot eradicate some infections. When the brain is infected with an agent that cannot be eradicated, amyloid beta keeps being produced and keeps trying and failing to eliminate the infection. Over the long term, the buildup of amyloid beta damages the cells that do the thinking, the neurons. So I doubt that gene editing techniques like CRISPR are going to prevent Alzheimer's, at least not for a long time. But I'm more optimistic about medicines that reduce the levels of amyloid beta and another molecule, tau, that appears important in causing Alzheimer's based on very recent research. And I'm also optimistic that as we learn more about the role of infections that may increase the risk of Alzheimer's, we may develop treatments and vaccines that target those infections and reduce the risk. Now, here's a very relevant article. It's called Insider Tips for a Smooth Recovery from Cataract Surgery. And it, again, comes from the Harvard Health Letter of November. Replacing a clouded lens inside the eye, a cataract, with an artificial lens is a routine procedure with a low risk for complications. That doesn't mean you can be complacent about recovery. You need to follow exactly the post-surgical plan that your doctor prescribes. You should always review the post-procedure instructions. The day of your procedure isn't the time to become familiar with complicated post-surgical instructions. For example, you'll need to use several types of prescription eye drops. There's an antibiotic eye drop you'll use for a week, and for 4 weeks you'll use a steroid drop to reduce inflammation, and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drop to help with pain and prevent swelling. Some of the drops will have to be tapered off according to a precise schedule, says Dr. Nandini Venkatsawaran, a cardiac surgeon at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts Eye and Ear. Ask about post-procedure instructions well in advance. If possible, pick up medications before the procedure, or arrange for someone to get them afterward and help you use them if necessary. If a complex eye drop regimen sounds challenging, ask your doctor if you can get a compounded eye drop. It must be made at a special pharmacy that can combine all three eye medications into one. It might cost more money and your insurance might not cover everything, so you need time to do some legwork, Dr. Venkatsawaran says. Learn the right way to use eye drops. Some people have a hard time using eye drops. When they squeeze a little plastic container, the drops don't get into their eyes. Learn how to use eye drops before the procedure. Practice with artificial tears in front of a mirror. Pull down the lower lid, look up, and place the drop in a little pocket that's created when you pull down the eyelid. Don't touch the eye or the eyelid with the tip of the dropper. The tip should be just above the eye. If it's hard to do, teach a loved one to do it for you. Store the drops in a clean environment to reduce infection risk. If you wear eyeglasses, removing cataracts will change your prescription in the affected eye. That eye might not even need a prescription lens anymore. If the other eye still needs correction, you can get a clear lens installed in the side of the glasses where the cataract was removed. Ask your doctor whether and when this should be done. After the procedure, you'll wear a clear plastic shield over the eye for 24 hours, and then at night only for a week, to protect it from things that can poke into it, like your pillow. When the shield comes off, Avoid exposing your eye to elements that can cause infection, like a pool or ocean water, or outdoor environments with dust and debris in the air. Don't hike, bike, or swim for a week. To keep your eye incision from reopening, avoid putting pressure on your eye in the days after surgery. No bending over, no lifting objects that are 10 pounds or heavier, no cleaning, vacuuming, or doing laundry. It's okay to do gentle walking, but don't jump around and get sweat in your eye, which could cause infection. Wait at least a week before resuming normal activities. Dr. Venkatesawaran finds that some people are scared to strain their eyes after the procedure. That's not a problem. For example, it's fine to read or work on a computer as long as you choose. Your depth perception might be off initially, so don't drive unless you're sure your vision is at least as good as it was before the procedure. Don't stress over differences. If you get a cataract removed from each eye a few weeks apart, don't worry if you have vision differences. You had natural differences in your eyes before surgery, and you may have some afterward. Give your eyes time to work together and adjust, and enjoy your new vision. Now, once again, from the Harvard Health Letter, here's an article entitled, Injuries and Blood Thinners, How to Stop Bleeding. Blood thinners are medications that make it harder for blood clots to form. Such clots can cause heart attacks, strokes, or leg vein clots that travel to the lung, all dangerous conditions. If you're at extra risk for these conditions, taking a blood thinner can reduce that risk. But the anti-clotting action also puts you at risk for uncontrolled bleeding if you get injured. It takes longer for any bleeding, even a small amount, to stop when you're on these medications, says Dr. K. Auchi, an emergency physician at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. Take the time now to learn how to respond to bleeding that can result from a number of scenarios. First is a minor cut or scrape. A minor cut or scrape isn't usually an emergency. The blood oozes out slowly, and you have plenty of time to stop it even if you're on a blood thinner. Hold the wound under running water to rinse out debris. Don't put in hydrogen peroxide because it might slow or impair healing. Apply pressure, lots of it. Cover the wound with your fingers or use a tissue, gauze pad, or clean cloth and press hard, Dr. Auchi says. If blood still leaks out, you're not applying enough pressure. You'd be surprised how much pressure it takes. It should hurt a little. The same principle applies if you have bleeding gums or a nosebleed, which might develop from a small cut or as a side effect of the blood thinner. Press on your gums or pinch the bridge of your nose as hard as you can for 10 minutes. If the wound is on an arm or a leg, raise the injured limb in the air while applying pressure, allowing gravity to help slow blood flow. Don't worry if it takes a long time or if the wound area turns blue. It would take 4 to 6 hours for any lasting damage to occur, and you won't need that much time. Keep applying pressure until you stop bleeding, then cover the wound with a bandage. If the bleeding doesn't stop or the wound needs stitches, go right to a hospital emergency department. Tell the staff that you're on a blood thinner. Serious injuries, no matter the size, don't ooze blood, they gush, most likely because there's damage near an artery. The heart keeps pumping blood, which pours out, and the blood thinner you're taking only makes it worse. This is life-threatening and warrants an immediate call to 911. Until paramedics arrive, apply as much pressure as possible to the wound. If the injury is on an arm or leg, tie a tourniquet as tightly as possible above the wound. Raise the injury up high above the heart. If the wound is on the torso, place a clean cloth on it and press as hard as possible. Don't let up. Once you're at the hospital, the staff needs to know that you're on a blood thinner. The fastest way to alert everyone is by wearing a medical bracelet. That's especially helpful if you're unconscious. You can get a bracelet with the words blood thinner online for less than $10. The medical team will know how to stop the bleeding and may give you a blood thinner antidote. You can't tell when an accident causes internal bleeding in your head or anywhere else in your body. So if you're on a blood thinner and you're injured or hit your head from a fall or an accident, go to the emergency department to get checked out at the first sign of trouble, like a headache or trouble seeing or confusion or nausea or lightheadedness. Tell the staff you're on a blood thinner. If the doctor orders imaging tests and they're clear, you may not be out of the woods. If you hit your head, there's a small chance that you'll have delayed bleeding that can take days or weeks to cause symptoms, Dr. Auchi says. If you feel worse after your initial evaluation, if you get a bad headache, you're vomiting, or you develop confusion, come back to see us as soon as possible so we can reevaluate and treat you. Now I'm going to switch to some news briefs. Again, this is in the Harvard Health Letter. And the first is entitled, A Large Study Finds the Sweet Spot for Daily Step Goals. Are you a step counter aiming for 10,000 steps per day? Many studies have suggested you don't need to hit that mark to maintain good health and live longer. And now the largest study to date backs that up. The research published online August 9, 2023 by the European Journal of Preventive Cardiology evaluated 17 high-quality studies from around the world, including a total of almost 227,000 people aged 18 and older who wore fitness trackers for a week and were then followed for about 7 years. Taking at least 3,900 steps per day was linked to significantly lower risks of dying from any cause. A reduction in death specifically from cardiovascular disease appeared with an even smaller number of daily steps, about 2,300. The data also showed that each 1,000-step increment was associated with a 15% decreased risk of dying. Every 500-step increment was tied to a 7% decrease in dying from cardiovascular disease. This study was observational and can't prove definitively that the number of steps people took lengthened their lives, but the finding underscored two common health messages. Even a little movement makes a difference, and more is better. Now, another article from the news briefs. Does poor sleep diminish the cognitive benefits of exercise? Getting at least 150 minutes of exercise every week is crucial to keeping your memory and thinking skills sharp. Exercise promotes the birth of new brain cells and increases the production of enzymes that break down amyloid proteins associated with dementia. Sleep also plays a role in cognitive health, flushing those amyloid proteins out of the brain. The right amount of sleep is so important that a lack of Z's may sabotage the cognitive perks of exercise. This is according to a study published in the July 2023 issue of Lancet Healthy Longevity. Researchers evaluated the periodic memory test results and self-reported sleep and exercise habits of 9,000 dementia-free people aged 50 and older who were followed over 10 years. Among people who started the study at age 50 or 60 and reported the highest rates of exercise, those who said they got less than 6 hours of sleep per night had faster rates of cognitive decline than those who said they got 6 to 8 hours of sleep. For people who started to study at age 70 and reported high rates of exercise, the amount of sleep they got didn't seem to affect their rate of cognitive decline. The study was observational and doesn't prove conclusively that poor sleep quashes the brain's benefits of exercise. Finally, there's a study entitled, The UK Study Confirms Mediterranean Lifestyle Benefits. Living a Mediterranean lifestyle, which means eating a particular diet and getting enough sleep and physical and social activity, has been linked over and over to reduced risk for chronic disease and early death. But most studies have involved people in Mediterranean countries like Spain. Now an observational study published online, August 8, 2023, by the Mayo Clinic Proceedings, suggests what experts have long suspected. The lifestyle has benefits for people living in other parts of the world, too. Researchers, including some from Harvard, analyzed diet assessments and self-reported lifestyle habits about 111,000 people aged 40 to 75 in England, Wales, and Scotland. Participants were followed up for 9 years. People who adhered most closely to a Mediterranean lifestyle had a 28% lower risk of dying from cancer and a 29% lower risk of dying prematurely from any cause, compared with people whose lifestyles were most different from the Mediterranean pattern. The authors say the findings indicate that people outside Mediterranean countries can use their own locally available products to follow a Mediterranean-style eating pattern, which emphasizes olive oil, fruits, vegetables, nuts, legumes, and whole grains, moderate amounts of fish, poultry, cheese, and wine, and limited amounts of red and processed meats. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. I sure hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.